The Book Nook on WISO is presented by the Greene County Public Library, with additional support from the Clark County Public Library, Washington Centerville Public Library, Wright Memorial Library, Dayton Metro Library, and Microsun Lamps.
Good morning. Welcome to the Best of the Book Nook on WISO. Back in 2002, I did my first interview with Chris Hedges. He had just published a book called War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning. And back in 2002, 9/11 was very fresh in our minds, and we were in a very warlike phase of our history with the invasion of Afghanistan and the pending invasion of Iraq. And today we have war in the headlines again, or at least the potential for war. We have a presidential election coming up next year. We have a president who is hoping to appear like a good leader. And what better way to lead than to lead us into a war? I'm not predicting anything, but we are certainly having some hostility right now between the United States and some other countries. And to look at that, I think this book is a great way to look back at war and what it means. Chris Hedges was a war correspondent for many years. He knows about war. He's seen many wars. In fact, he was taken prisoner by Saddam Hussein's Republican Guards during the Gulf War. He'll talk all about that on the Best of the Book Nook this morning. Hello, welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and today my guest is Chris Hedges. His new book is War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning. Welcome to the program, Chris.
Thank you, Vic.
Chris, you've had a lot of experience in war zones. Tell our listeners what your job has been for the last decade and a half.
I've been a war correspondent. I started covering the war in El Salvador in 1983. I was in Central America for 5 years. I took a sabbatical to study Arabic and then went to the Middle East and covered the First Intifada, as well as the conflict in Algeria, Southern Sudan. I covered the collapse of the communist regimes in East Europe and what was then Czechoslovakia, East Germany, Romania, and the Persian Gulf War. And then after the war, I was with the Shiites during the rebellion in southern Iraq, where I was eventually taken prisoner by the Iraqi Republican Guard. Went on to cover the Kurds, made two incursions into the marshes with the Shiites, civil war in Yemen, and then on to Sarajevo and Bosnia, and finally Kosovo.
How does a guy with a master's in divinity from Harvard end up being a war correspondent?
It really came about through reading, through a very close study of the Holocaust and the Spanish Civil War. You know, I began reading about those subjects when I was a teenager, and I longed for that kind of epic battle that could define my own life. You know, I went to Latin America quite consciously when I finished divinity school in the early 1980s because I thought it was as close as I was going to come in my lifetime to fighting fascism. And that's what drove me. I didn't study journalism. That's what drove me right out of divinity school to the war in El Salvador. Nevertheless, although that was the impetus that drove me into these conflicts, and when I got to El Salvador, the death squads were killing between 800 to 1,000 people a month. Of course, the Reagan administration was backing the military regime in El Salvador, as well as the Contra rebels later on in Nicaragua and the regime in Guatemala. I got caught up in the subculture of war and ended up sort of leaping from war zone to war zone for more than the next 15 years.
You got hooked. You got addicted to it, didn't you?
I would say it's a kind of addiction. You know, it gives a kind of adrenaline rush. It has an undeniable dark and grotesque fascination, maybe even beauty. The Bible warns against that, calling it the lust of the eye, and tells believers to beware of it. It becomes hard to exist outside that subculture that is war. All my friends were war correspondents, photographers. I defined myself that way. I found validation in it. I found empowerment in it. Yes, it's a sickness and it's an addiction. And by the time I was finished, I really needed to break free of it. I lost many friends, including finally my closest friend in May of 2000, who was killed in an ambush in Sierra Leone. And I realized that if I didn't stop, eventually war was going to consume me as well.
And your friend was buried in Sarajevo.
Yes, he and I, Kurt Schork, he was a correspondent for Reuters, and we started out together covering the war in Iraq. We were with the Kurds in northern Iraq and then went on to Sarajevo and then Kosovo, and his ashes were buried in the cemetery, Lions Cemetery in Sarajevo, for the victims of the war.
And he was buried next to some important people.
Yes, he was buried next to a couple that he had actually written about. They were a Serb and a Muslim, young lovers who had tried to escape the siege and had been gunned down as they fled across no man's land. Sarajevo was encircled, of course, by the Serb forces. Their bodies lay there for several days until they were finally retrieved. And you know, they became sort of known as the Romeo and Juliet of Sarajevo. Mm. They died in each other's... he died first, and then she crawled over and hugged him and died on top of him.
Chris Hadgetts joins us. The book is War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning. You begin the book with a poem from Wilfred Owen, who was a wonderful poet who didn't make it back from World War One. And when we look at World War One, something changed after Christmas 1914, didn't it?
Yes, that sort of spontaneous Christmas truce of 1914. You know, World War One was a seminal point because it introduced modern industrial warfare. You know, after most of the nations that went to war in the First World War were certain that within 4 months the war would be over, in part because they knew they would run out of their stockpiles of shells. And in fact, there was a shell crisis after 4 months. But what they did was mobilize the entire society behind war for total war, which has come to characterize war in modern times ever since. And the machines of war, the technology of war, were able to obliterate battalions, divisions, communities in a sustained way that had really not existed before. The whole landscape of war changed after World War One, and you know, I think you could argue in many ways that modern industrial warfare is not so much a product of modern industrial society, but the logical outcome of modern industrial society. And I think it's one of the reasons why we have such a hard time grasping the concept. I mean, ever since World War One, most of those who have died in warfare have been innocents. The vast majority have been innocents. And they die swift, impersonal, collective deaths. You know, World War One is the touchstone by which I think, you know, we have to look back and define our own era.
The book is War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning. Chris Hadgetts wrote it. He joins us in the Book Nook today on this Veterans Day. I think veterans of real war have a totally different perspective than the rest of us. And on Veterans Day, we have a lot of patriotic feeling. We have a lot of patriotic and nationalist feeling in our country right now. Did you start writing this book before September 11th, and what was the impetus for the book?
Yes, I began the book when I left the war in Kosovo. I took a fellowship at Harvard, a Nieman Fellowship, where I spent a year studying classics, and that's when the book began. And it was an effort to make sense or understand everything that I went through. Yes, I think veterans do have a sense of war. They're not often very good about communicating it. I find that the book that I wrote resonates most deeply with Vietnam veterans. You know, we see, you know, I had my father and all of my uncles fought in World War II, one of whom was quite badly wounded, never recovered, never was really able to live much of a life after the war. And we see, my father became a pacifist after the war and a Presbyterian minister. And we see now how that war has been turned into myth with, you know, books like The Greatest Generation or, you know, the writings of Stephen Ambrose or Cornelius Ryan and others. And that still has not happened to the Vietnam War. So I think Vietnam vets are much more acutely aware or able to articulate what war is. It's so much easier to believe the myth, to justify essentially industrial slaughter and atrocity, which is always part of war, by ennobling it. And there were some powerful memoirs that came out of World War II, but you see that mythology being created in many ways as an attempt to justify the prosecution of modern war. If you look at what happened to our country after our defeat in Vietnam, I think we became a better nation. We were forced to ask questions about ourselves, both as a people and a nation, that we had not asked before. We were forced to confront things within ourselves, things that we had committed and done that were painful. And war lost its glamour. It was stripped of that mythological veneer that always makes war. It's probably the only way that peoples or nations can prosecute war. You know, the end of the Vietnam War, that myth had imploded, and it became, let's call it a sensory war, in the sense that it was reported straight out for the, you know, the slaughter and brutality that it was, in the same way that when I reported in Sarajevo, I didn't have that gloss of myth. If I had been a Serb reporting back to a Belgrade paper, of course, my reporting would have been very different. I would have pushed this notion of Serb heroism and this kind of stuff. But this process, unfortunately, this process of humility and introspection changed, especially with the Reagan administration, with the invasion of Grenada, Panama, and it culminated with the Persian Gulf War, where war once again not only became respectable, but I would say even fun. It became a sort of a vast video arcade game. And that, I think, is very, very dangerous. I think we are in a situation now very similar to what many of the European empires were in at the end of the 19th century, where we have been lulled into this very false and dangerous illusion that our technology makes us safe, that somehow we can prosecute war cost-free. And as we see from the end of the 19th century, you know, the belief that our war machines can make us invulnerable is an illusion that can have very dangerous and tragic consequences.
You're listening to 91.3 WYSO, giving voice to our community, our nation, and our world. Since 1958, it's the best of the Book Nook. My 2002 interview with Chris Hedges will continue right after this. You're listening to the best of the Book Nook on WYSO today, reprising my 2002 interview with the journalist Chris Hedges, talking about his book, War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning. On the cover of your book, you've got a group of people. This looks like some event related to September 11th. They're waving flags, and it looks like New York City. Is that right?
Yes, it is.
Okay. After September 11th, we had a lot of people coming together. They had the hunt for Osama bin Laden, and a lot of people came together in New York City and all over the world, particularly in the United States, however, to forge this alliance against evil, against terrorism. We've heard a lot of verbiage and the war on terror, for instance. I think people are very afraid. I think people are afraid to speak up. The same generation that went through Vietnam and saw what war could do, I think is afraid to say anything about the flag waving and about the war passion that seems to be upon us right now.
That's always true in wartime, and you know, my fundamental goal when I began this book, was to understand the disease that is war and how in wartime this sickness of war infects both the individual and the society. So I think, Vic, you latch on to a very crucial point here. When we are at war, when a nation goes into war, we are only able to speak in the language the state gives us, in the jingos and the cliches that is handed to us, not only by the state but by the press, but essentially parroted or repeated by the press. We see that with the war on terror, the axis of evil, showdown with Iraq, so that whatever disquiet we feel, oftentimes we don't even have the words to say it. And the dead are always held up, the innocents who died in 9/11, to somehow silence any criticism. To become critical of the wartime effort is oftentimes to commit an act of treason. Everybody marches in the same step. Everybody speaks the same way. It's interesting in the conflicts that I've covered that there's a lot of talk about the effort in wartime to destroy the culture of the other. In Bosnia, we certainly saw this, and that's, you know, where the term we used quite frequently was cultural genocide. But what actually happens in wartime is that the state destroys their own culture first, or let's say their own authentic culture. Everything becomes infected with the jingoism of patriotism. And once the destruction of your own culture is complete, then you can turn on the culture of the enemy, on the culture of the other. And I think I see that here in the United States. I mean, a few weeks after 9/11 in New York, I woke up and I thought, you know, we've all become the Serbs. Patriotism is very thinly veiled self-glorification, nothing more. And it's intoxicating, it's ecstatic, one has a sense of belonging, one is suddenly made noble, the trivia and banality of daily life is left behind for the great cause. And yes, to question it is almost impossible. You often don't have the words for it, the language for it. Very few people want to listen, and to stand up against the cause as espoused by the state and the nation is to be seen as a traitor.
Clearly, the Iraqi regime is a genocidal, despotic regime. You detail in your book the atrocities committed against the Kurds by the Iraqis. You also describe your capture by the Republican Guard during the war in Kuwait. Clearly, there is great evil in this country, yet we see our Congress giving the president unbelievably expansive powers to wage war, including the use of nuclear weapons. This is somewhat troubling.
Well, Randolph Bourne wrote an essay in World War I called War is the Health of the State, and he was right. In wartime, we are willing to give those in power all sorts of prerogatives and rights to make decisions on our behalf that we would never do in peacetime. And yes, Congress has given President Bush the right to singly declare war on our behalf. And that, unfortunately, is not uncommon in wartime. That's frequently what happens in wartime. That also is a feature of modern warfare. In Britain, there were no passports before World War I. People sort of traveled where they wanted to. But along with that process of total war, of mobilizing an entire state or nation behind the war effort, came also the intrusion of the state into our personal lives. It gave the state the right to control us. And nations suddenly needed to know where their citizens were, where they were traveling, where they were going. This intrusion has always been a part of warfare in the last century, and is certainly a part now. And as the war on terror if you want to call it that. I don't think you can declare war against an idea, but as the war on terror is prolonged, and you know the Bush administration has told us that we're talking about a war that will go on for years, what you will also see is the further intrusion of the state into our private sphere, into the sphere of our own lives, and an increase of power in the hands of the very few.
My guest is Chris Hedges. The book is War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning, and it's recently been published by Public Affairs. He joins us by telephone from the East Coast today. Chris, you were captured by Saddam Hussein's Republican Guard as they fled from Kuwait. How did that happen, and are you amazed still that you're alive?
I'm often amazed that I'm alive. Mm-hmm. I've been through more than is probably healthy for most people to go through. I was in Kuwait City after the liberation. I'd gone in with the U.S. Marine Corps, and we'd heard that there was an uprising in Basra in the southern city of Iraq, and so I and a reporter from National Public Radio, Neil Conan, drove into Basra, where we were, where indeed not only Shiite rebels, but entire Iraqi army units had rebelled against the regime. And there was very heavy fighting, and we were eventually captured by Iraqi Republican Guard units and held for about a week. We were with a light armored battalion that tried to go north, was actually trying to get to Baghdad. There was no communications. The communications had been cut in the coalition bombing campaign. And we were very badly ambushed about 60 miles north of Basra and pinned down for 16 hours of fighting. Eventually, we were turned over to the International Committee of the Red Cross and flown in helicopters, UN helicopters, to Baghdad, and then taken by bus to Amman, Jordan, and released. And this was after a week. But it was harrowing, but, you know, there have been other harrowing moments, you know, throughout my career as well. I mean, El Salvador, many people forget, was a very brutal and dirty insurgency. 22 reporters, foreign reporters were killed in that war, as were 45 foreign correspondents and photographers in the war in Bosnia.
You describe Argentina during the Falklands crisis, and I didn't really understand what was going on in Argentina from reading our press here. I never really got it until I read your account, and you describe the war frenzy in Argentina and how when it all ended, they decided to go after foreign reporters, and they went after you, and the only thing that saved you was you pretended you were German.
Yes, I have blonde hair, and there was some debate among the other correspondents because, of course, I stood out in a crowd as to whether I should dye my hair black, which I never did. But when a mob turned on me, I said in Spanish, soy alemán, said I'm German, and they did not beat me. But they did very badly beat other foreign reporters. There was an AFP reporter who had finally lost his arm, and the BBC reporters had their car overturned and set alight, and they were very badly beaten. Yes, there was, and I think this is often true in wartime as well. It's very hard for people to accept their own culpability, and they look for, that external evil that caused their own demise and caused their defeat, and that's certainly what happened in Argentina. That's nothing uncommon in wartime.
I think if I ever had to look into a mass grave, that would cure any desire on my part to be involved in wars. You, unfortunately, have looked into more than one, and you describe how they have proliferated all over the globe. In fact, the ones in Trieste were particularly of interest to me. I had never heard of this.
Yes, the partisans occupied, these were Tito's Yugoslav partisans, occupied Trieste at the end of World War II after the Germans that had been there retreated. And they carried out large numbers of reprisal killings in the foibas or the caves around the city. We don't know. You know, thousands of people were executed. And there it's such a contentious issue that to this day they have not exhumed these bodies. And it remains a festering kind of wound. There is no... I mean, one of the most important things about reestablishing peace or reconciliation is giving to the opposing sides a common language, common vocabulary. That can't be done until there is a shared sense of reality. And so often in places like Bosnia or in Cyprus, this never happens. So you don't really have peace. You just have the absence of war. Hmm. Where you see this successfully taking place is South Africa because of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, where the victims stood and listened to their victimizers, their torturers, their murderers of the white apartheid regime get up and confess their crimes. They were given amnesty for this. But it made it impossible in South Africa to deny that these crimes took place. And that's fundamental. It's very, very, very important. This inability to create a common history, to create a common narrative, to create a common language makes peace impossible. And that's why I found the example in Trieste so fascinating, because here, 50 years on, it festered. It had been unresolved, and it remains very much a part not only of relations between the Slovene minority in the city and the Italians, but between the Yugoslavia, or now Slovenia, and the Italian state as well. It's absolutely fundamental that this takes place.
You also make the point that when a loved one has been lost, when a loved one has disappeared, finding out what happened to that person, finding the remains, is very important in the healing process.
Yes, this is one of the, cruelties of death squads that take away the body or take away a loved one and then never return the body. And you reach a point, or families reach a point, where all they ask finally in the end is for the body, for a body to grieve over, for some kind of closure. And that refusal to disclose where the body is or to turn the body over is itself a kind of torture that destabilizes families, that keeps them constantly on edge, increases their sense of anxiety, their sense of fear. It is really one of the, psychologically one of the cruelest things that despotic regimes or militias visit on their victims. And I've seen it, around the world. I recited Ariel Dorfman's book, Widows, where these bodies wash up on a shore and all the women in the village try and claim each body as their own, or that mm-hmm. French film, Life and Nothing But, with Philippe Noiret, where the end of World War II, it's an anti-war movie that I like very much. You have two women coming while they're exhuming the bodies from a battlefield, and it turns out they're both looking for the same corpse, and you need that corpse. And that is a very, very sad and... but fundamental part of coping with loss in wartime.
And making someone besides the lowly foot soldiers pay for the genocide. We see the trial in The Hague of Milosevic. We see Ratko Mladic and Radovan Karadzic running free still in the former Yugoslavia. Will they ever bring these leaders to justice for what they did?
But we have more hope of getting Radovan Karadzic because he's probably in Bosnia. Ratko Mladic, who is living in Serbia, is another matter. And I think that, the trial of Milosevic has turned out to be an interesting phenomenon because his popularity in Serbia has soared as he has fought to defend himself. And this has exposed, I think, the failure on the part of many Serbs to come to terms with their own role in the war, their own role in starting the war, prosecuting the war, and supporting a regime that carried out almost all of the atrocities. I mean, 80% of the victims in Bosnia were Muslims or Croats. And I think that in many ways Serbian society is trapped and will never be able to move forward until they confront their own culpability in a way that, for instance, you know, the Germans were forced to after the end of World War II, and we're seeing the sickness in Serbian society play itself out as they watch the trials. These are broadcast live, of course, in Serbia, and rather than reflect on their own guilt, on their own responsibility for what took place, and it was the Serb nationalist regime under Slobodan Milosevic that began the wars in Yugoslavia, they find it easier and prefer to see themselves as victims. And societies will remain frozen in very frightening and dangerous sort of time warps when they can't confront their own culpability, as I think we did at the end of the Vietnam War, and we became a healthier society for that.
You are listening to the Best of the Book Nook on WYSO. Going back 17 years into our Book Nook archive for my first interview with Chris Hedges for a book that is the most powerful anti-war book I have ever read. It's called War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning, and we'll bring you more of that interview following this. You're listening to the Best of the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and we went back 17 years for my interview with Chris Hedges, and when I originally did this interview, I ended it by playing Edwin Starr, War, What Is It Good For? Absolutely nothing. Let's continue now with the Best of the Book Nook. My guest is Chris Hedges. His book is War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning. There's a pornographic element to war. You talk about what happened in Serbia and Yugoslavia. In fact, you make the statement in the book that war is necrophilia. Explain.
There is an erotic element in war, and that's something that the Greeks understood very well in their mythology, where you had the god of war and the goddess of love having an illicit affair. The goddess of love was married to Hephaestus, but had an affair with Ares, who was hated by the other gods. You see it in, there's a wonderful scene on a vase in the Metropolitan Museum of Art where from the Trojan War, where Achilles is killing the queen of the Amazons, Penthesilea. And according to the myth, when he thrusts his spear into her body, their eyes meet. And on the vase, you see that moment, and they fall in love.
As he's killing her.
As he's killing her.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But, of course, when she dies, love dies. And, there is a pornographic quality to war. There is the lust of war and erotic lust are closely akin, because pornography renders bodies into objects, just as war does. In war, human beings are objects either to control, to gratify, or to kill. And oftentimes, all three of those things take place. So that rendering in eroticism of the other into an object is very much part of what war is about. We render others into objects, and we do this verbally. We are doing it now in our own society with those that oppose us. We talk about them as being barbarian, as not being civilized, as and they speak about us in the same way. I mean, we're infidels, and there's a frightening mirror kind of process, mirroring that's sort of going on, this frightening process where our rhetoric and theirs match each other's. And always you begin verbally by dehumanizing the other, by rendering the other as linguistically into an object before they literally become an object, which is a corpse. So it's no accident that in wartime society, sexual perversion, casual sexual encounter is on the rise, on the increase. It's why rape is so much a part of war. And I think it's why love is so difficult in wartime, not only to establish, but to sustain.
You also talk about being a war correspondent and how you had a really hard time sleeping at night and having bad dreams. And the only time this seemed to go away is when you were staying with a couple that was in love.
Yes, and oftentimes in the Balkans, these were mixed couples. They would be a Serb and a Muslim, because they didn't find their identity, their sense of self-worth in the nationalist covenants that were handed to them by the state. They found it within each other. And they were so much more able to see the dignity and the sanctity of life in others. And these were always refuges. They provided, these homes or apartments provided a refuge of sanity for me. They weren't capable of engaging in that hate rhetoric that supported the violence against the other. Oftentimes, these people became victims of the war as well. The love that they had and the love that they radiated was not able to change much, and sometimes not even able to protect them. But it was a potent reminder of what the sanctity of human life is, what love is, what we should strive for as human beings. And it radiated a strange kind of power in the midst of wartime, a disturbing and disquieting kind of power. And that happened in every conflict that I was ever in.
And we go back to those anti-war songs of the 60s and lyrics like, love is the answer, and it always is, isn't it?
Well, Freud and Civilization and Its Discontents, a book he wrote in 1931 on the eve of Hitler's rise to power and of course, World War II, of the two great forces in human society and human life being Eros, the force of love, and Thanatos, or the death instinct. And Freud argued that these two forces were in eternal conflict, with one ascendant at one time within a human society and another ascendant at another time. And because of this, Freud believed that war was inevitable, that war could never be eradicated because of this constant kind of tension. And I think that Freud was right. I think if you look at what happened to us as a nation, again, after the Vietnam War, you could say that Eros was ascendant. And if you look at us since the Persian Gulf War, you would have to say that Thanatos, or the death instinct, is ascendant. Mm. And only when we become punished, only when we pay for this necrophilia in blood and pain, do we wake up to the illusion that we have fallen for. And war is a god, as the ancient Greeks and Roman knew, and it begins with the call for the annihilation of the other. But ultimately, if you don't understand the poison that war is, it ends with self-annihilation.
My guest is Chris Hedges. The book is War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning. This is a powerful book. When I read one particular story in here, it made me cry, and I've recounted it to others, and it made them cry as well. It's a story about a cow.
Hmm. Yes, it's the story of a Bosnian Muslim who was a poor farmer in the enclave of Garajda. and he had three cows. And he would have to milk the cows at night because of the sniper fire. The enclave was surrounded during the war by the Serbs. And there were some Serb families living in Garajda who did not go to the Serb side, and I interviewed one of the families after they had left Garajda. And they had had two sons, one of whom had joined the Bosnian Serb army and eventually been killed, and then the other who had stayed in Garajda and then been taken away by Muslim police and disappeared. His body never returned. After he was gone, his wife gave birth to a small infant. She couldn't breastfeed the child. There was no food. And after 10 days, the infant started to die. And they were feeding him or having him drink tea. And there was a knock early in the morning, and it was this farmer who brought them a liter of milk and refused to take any money for it. And he did this for 200 and some days. But very soon, milk was very precious, worth a lot of money. It was very hard to get. And very soon, the other Muslim, or the other Muslim families in the apartment building were aware that he was climbing up these steps every day in his rubber boots and delivering a liter of milk to a Serb baby. And they began to spit at him, to revile at him, to call him names. But he wouldn't stop, and eventually they left Garajda, and the baby survived. And when I found him after the war, his three cows had died, his apartment had been bombed out. He was sleeping in a corridor with several other homeless men. He was picking worm-eaten apples and spreading them out on a piece of newspaper and selling them on a sidewalk. And I had heard his story from this Serb family, who of course hated the Muslims, but stopped and said at the end, "But not all Muslims are bad. We have to tell you this story of Fado Fazic." When I went and found him, his first question was, "How was the baby?" And it was an action that perhaps in wartime seemed futile, but one that small child, who will certainly outlive him, will be told. And that kind of blind hatred for the other, which is part of nationalism, she'll never be able to repeat just or support, just as that family never will. And those actions are momentous in wartime. They are heroic, and they reverberate and have a power that we can't ignore.
The trend is not typically towards humanity, it's towards dehumanization, and you accentuate that point by describing the Polish police who were asked to execute people.
Right. This is from Christopher Browning's book, Ordinary People, where, human beings are dehumanized, herded into groups, once they become dirty, they're not seen as individuals, and that's certainly why in the concentration camps everyone had numbers rather than names, it becomes easier to kill them. It's that stripping them of their humanity in order to carry out slaughter, and that is a crucial point a crucial element in war, and one which we must always resist, and we must resist it now as we cannot allow this rhetoric to dehumanize Muslims or dehumanize Iraqis because we become like them, and there becomes no difference between us and them. War is, I'm afraid, inevitable, probably an inevitable part of the human condition, but it is always tragic. There is nothing glorious about it, nothing good about it. And, just as a cancer patient must ingest a poison to fight off the disease, there are times when perhaps we are forced to ingest war. But it is a poison. And surely if we don't understand it, it will kill us. And I worry now as a society and as a nation that we don't understand it.
And we try so hard to make excuses for things that are unpleasant. I can remember growing up in the Midwest, and on those hot days in July when it was absolutely insufferable, people would say, well, it's good for the corn. And now you hear people say, well, war is going to be good for the economy. I don't buy it. But
well, our whole economy is pretty distorted by war anyway. We sell more arms abroad than every other nation on the face of the earth combined. You know, that distortion that war has caused is, and that the military-industrial complex causes to American society predates war. You know, war is a manufactured commodity, and the machines of war are manufactured commodities. And, you know, oftentimes once you empower a certain group or a certain nation with that technology of war, then you have to manufacture the war itself. I've never seen much good come out of war. And too often we limit ourselves to measuring the damage in wartime in physical terms, in terms of villages or infrastructure. But there's a huge psychological toll that war takes on whole generations. And that damage may be even more severe. It certainly made, you know, at the end of World War One, probably made World War Two inevitable. And it ripped apart our own country after the Vietnam War. I think we still feel the reverberations of it as much as we try to ignore it. I think we felt it after World War Two. I mean, you know, I know from growing up in a family where there were combat veterans in my family, all of whom were scarred deeply by the war, that psychological damage is one that can, you know, render a society or a country with a kind of collective sickness for years and years and years. You certainly see that in the Balkans. It will be probably one or two generations before people can begin to have, let's call them, normal lives, aside from the physical devastation.
Yeah. Well, my dad was a 2nd Division Marine who fought the Japanese in places like Saipan, and two-thirds of his division never came back. And on days like today, Veterans Day, I think of him, and he never liked to talk about the war. And I don't think he was ever the same.
Right. I don't think you ever are. You know, having... although I never carried a weapon, I certainly am not. I mean, these are things that I will have to bear with me for the rest of my life.
Well, Chris, we really appreciate you taking time to share your book with us today on the program.
Not at all, Vic. It was a pleasure.
You've been listening to Chris Hedges, recorded back in 2002. For the Best of the Book Nook, the book is War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning. What a powerful book. That is the strongest anti-war statement I have ever read. I've had Chris back on the show a number of times since then. That was the most upbeat interview I've had with him. Over the years, he has gotten less and less optimistic. And I'm sure right now, as it looks like we could be heading into more wars somewhere in the world, that Chris is feeling fairly pessimistic about that. He really knew about war. He had been there. He had experienced it. He described what it was like to be taken prisoner by the Iraqi Republican Guard, and what a miracle it was for him and his fellow captive, Neil Conan from National Public Radio, to be rescued and shuttled out of the country by the Red Cross. That was during the invasion of Kuwait. And what a story. What an experience. And I think that someday, if there's any justice, that Chris will be honored for his work for peace. And I can't think of any better way to honor him than giving him the Dayton Literary Peace Prize, but that's just my opinion. Coming up tomorrow in the Book Nook, T.J. Turner returns to the program. 10:30 Sunday morning, we'll be talking to him about his new historical novel. It's a thriller. It's a spy novel. It's called Angel in the Fog. T.J. Turner returns for a third turn at the microphone. That's tomorrow morning at 10:30 right here on WYSO.